Welcome to the In Context War Report, produced by MDR Productions, Inc. The In Context War Report is broadcast at noon on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. Our website is incontextreport.com. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'm joined by the War Report's military affairs commentator, Marshawn McDermott Rowe. In the War Report, we report on recent developments in war and geopolitics around the world. By placing these developments in historical context, we show how they affect global stability and U.S. national security. There have been important developments in the war against ISIS. In addition to the battles in Syria and Iraq, recent terror attacks in Egypt, Beirut, and Paris show that the ISIS war theater has no boundaries. But first, we turn to Asia and the growing confrontation between China and the U.S. and the South China Sea. Marshawn, what is this dispute about?
What it really is about is China is trying to not only push out its borders, but it's also trying to expand into areas that are potentially rich with oil and natural gas reserves. Now, we're not entirely certain exactly how many resources may be at the bottom of the South China Sea, but we do know that throughout the region of what China has classified as its defense zone, include the islands that were seized from the Japanese as well, there are numerous deposits of oil and natural gas. So I think what this really is about for the Chinese is trying to expand outwards and make themselves more energy independent, because as it stands, China is very much at the mercy of the outside world when it comes to its natural resources. Most of their oil and natural gas is actually imported from Russia. It stands to reason that the Chinese want to expand outwards. And in another way, too, it also humbles their neighbors because it demonstrates that they are the Pacific power. If they want something, they can take it, as opposed to the Americans, the United States, where it makes us appear weak because we cannot enforce international law. We cannot force the Chinese to give up these artificially man-made islands. And realistically speaking, the Filipinos, the Vietnamese, the Malaysians don't have the military capacity to do it themselves. So it really is also a way of the Chinese establishing their dominance as a Pacific power.
In addition, the South China Sea is a very important area for trade. $5 trillion worth of goods pass through the South China Sea every year.
It's much in the same way as it is important for the Egyptians to control the Suez Canal. You know, if the Egyptians were to shut down the Suez Canal, it gives them a tremendous amount of economic power. And so much in the same way as the Egyptians controlling the Suez Canal gives them economic power, controlling this incredible shipping lane gives the Chinese power. Because imagine the damage it would do not just to Asian economies, but to our economy if the Chinese were to say, you know what, United States, you know what, American president, we don't like what you're doing, whether it's rearming Japan or expanding your military assets in the Pacific, we're going to shut down trade passing through the South China Sea. That would hurt the region, but it would also have a global impact. So controlling that region, having military assets in that region, having these artificially man-made islands, these naval bases, these airstrips in the region does give them a great deal of control and power over the global economy by controlling those trade routes.
Now, the United States has decided to challenge China's claim to this 12-mile territorial zone around the Spratly Islands by having regular patrols of U.S. warships through the area. Is that going to have any effect on China? And how dangerous is it? The Chinese have warned the U.S. that any provocative acts, quote, in the South China Sea could provoke a war with the U.S.
Well, for the time being, I think the Chinese are treating us more or less the way a horse would treat gnats. You know, the way a horse will swipe its tail at flies and gnats because it finds them irritating. It doesn't spook the horse, but the horse just finds them annoying. At this stage, that is pretty much the way the Chinese view the United States and our probing efforts. We're irritating, we're a nuisance, but right now we're not impeding the development of their man-made islands. Short of us actually going and evicting the Chinese from those islands, none of these efforts are actually doing anything to stop the Chinese from building a massive naval base in the South China Sea, if that's what they end up deciding to do. However, this could change if the United States actually decided we are going to enforce international law, we are going to force the Chinese to give up these man-made islands and try to evict them by the presence of our military, then I think we would run the risk of an open confrontation. But at least as it stands, the efforts that we're putting forward are so symbolic, the Chinese really, I think, can afford to just sort of ignore us while they continue doing what they're doing, because nothing that we're doing currently is impeding the development of these man-made islands.
If there were to be a war with China in the Pacific, do we have enough forces to effectively oppose them? And are we spread too thin with our present antagonism towards Russia and Europe and the Mideast?
With the current downsizing of our forces, we really are spread far too thin. As it stands, if we were to enter into a conflict with just the Chinese in the Pacific alone, having so much of our military assets in Europe and in the Middle East, it would already put us on the back foot. But let's not forget, the Chinese and the Russians cooperate militarily. They also have what I believe to be a mutual defense agreement that they signed back in 2004. So in the event of a conflict, we run the risk of dragging the Russians in and fighting a two-front war against the world's two largest military superpowers at a time when our military is smaller than it was before World War II, and at a time when we have no more industrial capacity. It would be very dangerous. I mean, you have to remember that when World War II broke out, all of the factories that were manufacturing cars suddenly started manufacturing tanks and trucks and jeeps. All of the local firearms manufacturers suddenly started turning out their shotguns, M1 Garands. We can't do that anymore. We lack that industrial capacity. This really puts us on the back foot relative to countries like China and Russia that have a massive industrial capacity. Obviously, the Chinese manufacture a lot of cars for us now. I doubt they'd be willing to manufacture tanks for us in the event of a war.
Yes. Well, we pointed out for at least a year on the show, our policy towards Russia, antagonizing Russia, has really driven the Russians into the arms of the Chinese. Query, which country represents a more fundamental threat to U.S. national interests, Russia or China?
I personally would say that China is a much greater threat, by and large, because we're entering a period of Chinese history that we really haven't seen before. China was always a very insular country, and it never really expanded beyond its borders. China has existed as the state of Qin since the year 300 BC. They have an ancient history, but in the same vein, during that time, they've never expanded beyond their borders, with the exception when they were occupied by the Mongols. Even then, it was a Mongol dynasty, not a Chinese dynasty. So we're seeing now an expansion beyond China's borders. And this does make it more unpredictable. There is an antagonism towards the West because of the Opium Wars. China's being divided up between the European powers, the Boxer Rebellion, in which, you know, the U.S. became a player in China, followed by the Chinese Civil War. Really, 100 years of Chinese history going from stability and prosperity under the previous Manchu rulers to then anarchy and civil war and being divided up between the Western nations created a sense in the Chinese mind that this shall never happen again. We will never be at the mercy of the West again. And that is why China, I think, poses the greatest threat. And then the other factor that we have to remember, too, is China is still communist. This is a society that does not adhere to the same principles that we in the West do, concepts such as even freedom of religion or freedom of speech. Our basic democratic Western rights are things that aren't adhered to in China. And so this does put us at natural odds with the Chinese. Now, on the flip side, the Russians are not a free and democratic society. Let's not forget that. But the Russians are not communist anymore. They have much more in common with us because just like us, just like the United States, Russia is a melting pot nation. It has many, many different ethnicities and many, many different religions. They have Muslims, they have Christians, they have Jews, they have Buddhists. They share a lot of those very basic Western cultural traits. So it's a lot easier to get along with the Russians. And in the same vein, too, Russia's primary concern has always been its security. They will poke and prod and they want to expand their influence around the world, but Russia never had colonies per se. You know, they always had communist puppet states, but never in the same vein as the rest of the Western world during the Great Game, when the European powers were grabbing for colonies in Africa and in Asia and whatnot. The Russians were concerned with the countries on their borders. They fought the Ottomans relentlessly and the Austro-Hungarians because they wanted to protect their borders, because Russia has this historical paranoia of being invaded. The reason why the Russians grabbed so much territory at the end of World War II was because Stalin said that never again would Germany have the power to invade Russia. Truman knew he could cut a deal, because if he could guarantee the Soviets their security, more or less, the integrity of their empire, or their integrity of their sphere of influence, it means that he would be guaranteeing the Russians an element of security. The Russians, at the end of the day, will prefer security over the risk of an open conflict.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott Rowe, your host, and I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott Rowe, our military affairs commentator. And we've been talking about the growing confrontation between the United States and China in the South China Sea, where China's claiming an ever larger territorial zone based upon, in large part upon, the construction of artificial islands. Marshawn, now I'd like to move on to the war with ISIS, the militantly anti-Western, anti-Christian Islamic group, which now controls large parts of Syria and Iraq and has greatly expanded its operations through far-flung terrorist attacks. The war in Syria began about 4 years ago as a U.S.-supported revolt against the Syrian government. Much of the anti-government fighting was carried out by foreign jihadists brought to Syria by U.S. allies. However, as predicted by U.S. intelligence officials, the jihadists morphed into the powerful anti-Western entity known as ISIS, which last year extended its reach east to Iraq. The current fighting in Syria and Iraq is a multi-sided, multi-front affair. The Syrian government has the strong military support of Russia, together with soldiers from Iran, Cuba, and Lebanon's Hezbollah. Russia is also involved in Iraq with the establishment of a joint information center in Baghdad, which includes Iran. The U.S., alarmed at the growing power of its former jihadist surrogates, is now fighting ISIS from the air, while still calling for the overthrow of the Syrian government. At the same time, the U.S. is worried that Russian support for the Syrian and Iraqi governments will lead to greater Russian influence in the region. ISIS is not only vigorously defending its positions in Syria and Iraq, but recently extended the war with large terror attacks elsewhere. Marshawn, let's first look at the fighting in the northern parts of Syria and Iraq near the Turkish border, where much of the anti-ISIS fighting is being done by the Kurds. Who are the Kurds, and why are they fighting ISIS?
The Kurds are an ethnic group that have a very, very ancient history in the Middle East. They are predominantly Sunni Muslim, although there is a portion of the Kurdish population that is Shia, as well as there are also Yazidi Kurds, and they are Christian Kurds. The Kurds are a distinct ethnic group from the Arabs in that they have their own language and their own separate identity. The Kurds have always been in the shadow of their Arab neighbors, but have still maintained a very strong sense of their own independence, whether it was during the times of the Abbasid caliphates and the Umayyads, or whether during the times of the Turkish caliphates, the Kurds always maintain their own distinct identity.
What would you say is the quality of the Kurdish army?
They're very highly trained and very highly motivated and very well led. They have a long history of fighting against not just their Arab neighbors, but fighting against the Turks specifically and the Iranians as well. They also fought vigorously against Saddam Hussein and were really on the receiving end of Saddam Hussein's chemical weapons. So they have a lot of combat experience behind them. They worked very closely with U.S. Special Forces, and their combat effectiveness has really proven itself in the fight against ISIS in terms of their ability to hold their own and their battlefield victories, not to mention the fact that they've been getting pounded from the air by the Turks while still trying to fight ISIS.
The U.S. is supporting the Kurdish fighting against ISIS from the air as well, right?
Yes. It gets kind of complicated because there are two Kurdish entities. There's the Kurdish Autonomous Government, which we support with airstrikes, and they're the nominally legitimate Kurdish government as we recognize it. And then there's the Kurdish PKK. They're the rebels who are fighting against the Turks, and they're doing a lot of the fighting in Syria. And while the autonomous government is in Iraq, now it gets complicated because the Turks are bombing the PKK Kurds from the air, and we're supporting the autonomous Kurds from the air. So there's a lot of weird, convoluted overlap with that one.
The Kurds that we are working with, what is their military objective in northern Iraq and northern Syria?
Right now, it's to drive out ISIS and to ultimately maintain Kurdish autonomy, because within the Iraqi state as it stands, Kurdistan, or most of northern Iraq, is nominally autonomous. They work within the Iraqi government, but they govern their own affairs from Erbil. The Kurds from the Kurdish Autonomous Region of Iraq, the Kurdish Autonomous Government, is different than the ones fighting in Syria, because the ones fighting in Syria are predominantly Kurdish PKK. And what they're trying to do, by and large, is establish an independent Kurdistan.
And the fighting that's going on at the moment between the Kurds and ISIS really has to do with the control of a highway which runs from Raqqa, the ISIS headquarters in Syria, east to Mosul, the large Iraqi city which was conquered by ISIS. So the fighting there is now, as I understand it, about breaking that highway link.
This is true, because Mosul is pretty much the headquarters of ISIS operations in Iraq. Raqqa is the ISIS de facto capital, but Mosul is the headquarters of their operations in Iraq. If you were to split the highway between Raqqa and Mosul, you would effectively split ISIS forces. The victory has been slow coming. The Kurds would launch an offensive, whether it was to relieve the attack on Erbil, the capital of the Kurdish Autonomous Region, or whether it was fighting in northern Syria, whether it was fighting around Mosul. One of the things that you see is that when the Kurds would launch an offensive, ISIS would move in a lot of its foreign fighters, a lot of these Chechens, Europeans, a lot of these battle-hardened professional soldiers, and they would come and they'd beat back the Kurds, and then an offensive would be launched in Syria by the Syrian army, and then ISIS would immediately shift its forces back to Syria.
So controlling this highway will really impede that, and Press TV, the Iranian news outlet, reported on November 13th that the Kurdish army had entered Sinjar, which is a key position, mountainous position, along the Raqqa to Mosul highway.
They won't be able to split the highway so long as ISIS is able to bring in those elite foreign fighters to beat them back, because they're the only ones that can go toe-to-toe with the battle-hardened Kurds. There's an offensive going on by the Syrian army in Syria with the support of Russian ground troops, Cubans, and the support of Hezbollah and Iranian troops in Syria. At the same time, the Kurds are launching their offensive. This is giving the Kurds an advantage because it's splitting ISIS forces. So long as ISIS is forced to fight on two fronts, it cannot utilize its shock troops to the fullest advantage.
Well, let's talk about the Russian offensive in Syria, an air campaign, since around November the 1st. 2,300 combat missions since then have been launched from inside Syria by the Russians. In addition to that, there have been long-range bombers flying from Russia, which they claim have destroyed 140 Syrian targets of ISIS. And in just in the last few days, Russia's fired 34 cruise missiles from the eastern Mediterranean, hitting more than a dozen targets in Aleppo and Idlib in Syria. So we're seeing the Russians move very aggressively.
The Russians are very effective because they have a lot of troops on the ground. Their Spetsnaz, their special forces, are operating on the ground. They're able to direct these airstrikes. So they have a large volume of airstrikes coming in, but they're being delivered against command and control centers. They're being delivered against armories. They're being delivered against munitions factories, against ISIS armored units. On the other hand, right now, the United States is relying very heavily on covert intelligence and on drones in order to gather the intelligence and drop the airstrikes. Well, the end result of this is that we cannot effectively drop as many bombs as the Russians are. If we were to have more special forces operating on the ground, or indeed more conventional forces calling in and directing airstrikes, we probably would be able to deal the same sort of damage and the same volume as the Russians.
Another factor in the air campaign in Syria is the French. Particularly since the Paris terror attack, the French conducted a massive aerial bombardment of ISIS headquarter targets in Raqqa, Syria.
And certainly the Russians and the French have agreed to work with each other on the issue of combating ISIS. This means that the French don't need to have special forces on the ground. If, for example, somebody using, let's say, a laser to mark the target, whether that's a Russian operator or a French operator becomes immaterial if you're sharing the intelligence.
And in terms of international involvement, it's also interesting to note that Russia's ally Iran is leading an attack on the Aleppo front, supported by Lebanese Hezbollah fighters. They are engaged in an effort to retake parts of Aleppo captured by ISIS. And Aleppo is a commercial, very important commercial center in northwestern Syria. These attacks are backed by with Russian air support. And the attacks also appear to be directed against both ISIS and other rebel groups. Presumably some of these other rebel groups would be ones that the U.S. in the past has supported.
Putin, he views the offensive as an offensive against all anti-Assad entities. And now I'm sure there are plenty of entities in Syria. Assad's not a nice guy. I'm sure there are plenty of people who want him gone. And I'm sure that there are plenty of so-called moderates. But the fact is that the ones that are fighting right now, the ones that make up the bulk of the Syrian Free Army, tend to be entities like the al-Nusra Front, which is al-Qaeda in Syria. And that's why they're pushing against the Free Syrian Army, as well as ISIS in Aleppo. And they also recently broke the siege of an airfield near Aleppo. And this was a huge morale booster for the Syrian Army because it represented a quantitative victory. This airport near Aleppo had been under siege since 2013. So a two-year siege was broken when Syrian forces, spearheaded by Iranians and Lebanese Hezbollah, broke the siege.
The U.S. has also been conducting an air campaign, and this is directed against oil resources of ISIS. ISIS finances most of its operations through black market oil revenues, and the U.S. has destroyed about 115 oil trucks used by ISIS in Deir ez-Zor in eastern Syria. The oil originates at the Omar oil fields in that province. So the idea is to break down their ability to finance their operations. The U.S. air campaign is directed against targets like trucks because the United States does not want to destroy the Syrian oil infrastructure, which would be very expensive and time-consuming to rebuild. It is reported that the United States is also sharing intelligence with France on targeting. So there seems to be a lot of activity by the Western nations. The French are coordinating with the United States. The French are coordinating with the Russians. Is the United States coordinating with Russia?
No, not right now, because the real reason why we're supporting the so-called moderates to begin with is not because we necessarily trust these guys. The reason why we're supporting the moderates is because they're anti-Russian. They're anti-Assad, which makes them anti-Russian. We're not going to cooperate with the Russians because at the end of the day, we know we can defeat ISIS. It's Russian influence in the Middle East that we're worried about post-conflict. And that's where we will not cooperate militarily with the Russians any more than is necessary to prevent us from accidentally shooting at each other.
The U.S. is really in a quandary. We really fomented this uprising in hopes that we could dislodge Assad and put in a pro-American government. And as our own intelligence agencies predicted 3 years ago, the people we were supporting, these jihadists we were bringing into the country, evolved into a force that was effective and beyond our control and totally anti-Western. We've got to somehow deal with this Frankenstein we created. At the same time, the Russians enter the fray as they have, and they save the day by defeating ISIS. Their influence in Syria will be greater than it ever was.
Absolutely. And that's one of the quandaries that we're in, because the administration, our military leaders know that the only way to defeat ISIS is to go in boots on the ground into Iraq and deal a death blow. Take the cities, take the streets, and smash ISIS from the ground. The problem is, though, is that nobody wants to commit to that. They're willing to let the Russians do the ground fighting. The problem is that if we let the Russians and the Iranians and the Syrians do the ground fighting, obviously their influence in the Middle East will ultimately push ours out. What is more important, maintaining U.S. hegemony in the Middle East or letting the Russians have hegemony in the Middle East?
Because or curbing ISIS, which is a threat to just about everybody.
Well, exactly. And that's where we have to decide, because at the end of the day, the greatest threat is ISIS. It doesn't matter. And we can cut a deal. And that's what I've been advocating for the longest time. ISIS is the threat. We can live with the Russians and we can deal with Iran later. We need to cut a deal with the Russians. Tell them, listen, you can have influence in Syria. We get influence in Iraq. Fine. You will hammer ISIS from Syria. We will send in 50,000 ground troops and we will smash them in Iraq. And then we can figure out who's going to have dibs in the Middle East. During World War II, we decided number one priority was defeat Nazi Germany. Then we would sort everything out with the Russians later. And then you got the Cold War, but you had relative stability. On the other hand, our policy now is tantamount to us saying, you know what, we're not going to fight the Nazis, but instead we're going to try to undermine the Soviets.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott-Rowe, your host, and I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott-Rowe, our military affairs commentator. And we've been updating you on the situation in the war in Syria and Iraq against ISIS. Well, now, in addition to the ground war and the air war in Syria and Iraq, the battle with ISIS took a particularly ugly turn recently with three large-scale terror attacks in Egypt, Lebanon, and France. On October 31st, a Russian passenger plane bound for St. Petersburg exploded shortly after taking off from the Egyptian resort town of Sharm el-Sheikh. All 224 passengers, mostly Russians, were killed. ISIS's Egyptian affiliate took credit for bringing down the plane, which experts now believe was taken out with a bomb. On November 12th, ISIS committed bombings in Beirut, killing 43 and wounding 200. The bombs targeted civilians in a Shia Hezbollah neighborhood known to be friendly to Assad, the leader of Syria. And in Paris, 129 people were killed by shooting and bombing in several air terror attacks. Again, ISIS claimed credit. Marchand, why did ISIS choose these three targets, Egypt, Lebanon, France?
France and Russia are participating in the coalition against ISIS. Russia and France both actively bombing ISIS forces. So it stands to reason that ISIS is deciding, well, we can't knock out the Russian aircraft. We can't defeat the French Air Force. However, we can target their civilians. And that really, I think, is what ISIS is going for. The most punishing for any nation is the death of its innocents, its unarmed men, women, and children. It is an incredibly low blow, but it is often a tactic used by insurgent and terrorist armies who can't effectively fight against your soldiers, against your army. If ISIS were going to attack the United States, which sadly seems to be the pattern is what they're heading towards, if they were to attack the United States, they wouldn't hit us on our military installations. They wouldn't attack our Air Force. They'd hit our women and children. And that's exactly what they did in France. And that's exactly what they did in Russia, to punish the French, to punish the Russians. At the same time, also in Lebanon, it's the same thing, because Lebanese Hezbollah has been involved in dealing a lot of battlefield defeats to ISIS. So again, it's the same way to punish the Lebanese. It's the same way to punish the Shia for standing up to them, for fighting. Again, they can't defeat Hezbollah on the battlefield. So what are they going to do? They're going to hit their women and children at home.
France was a colonial power in Syria for many years. Syria was part of the territory claimed by France during World War I under the secret Sykes-Picot Treaty, in which the British and the French divvied up the Ottoman Empire. And the French actually broke up an Arab government set up in Syria right after World War I, and they kept troops in Syria until 1946. So there's a long-standing animosity between Arabs and the French, at least some Arabs and the French.
True, but I think a lot more of that is of the older generation than the younger generation.
Yes.
Because at least my experiences when I was in the Middle East, attitudes towards the colonial powers tended to be much more of, we're going to blame them for the reason why our government's corrupt. What they hearken back to, what the extremists hearken to, is the Crusades. That, to them, is the culminating event in their history.
And, really, of course, the French were the leaders of the First Crusade.
Exactly, but they don't even necessarily discern between the French and other Europeans. By and large, when you look at extremists, you're not dealing with a very educated or sophisticated population. You're dealing with an entity that has a cursory understanding of history. Even though the Franks actually made up the first wave of crusaders that came over, most people in the Arab world, particularly most people on the poorer end of the spectrum, don't know that. All they know is that the European crusader, the Western crusader, the non-Muslim crusader came and occupied the Holy Lands, and there was a glorious war fought to liberate the Holy Lands. They drove the Christian crusader out. For the extremists, the Crusades is their main propaganda point, because it, on the one hand, speaks to a very horrific war in which they were humiliated, but then it also speaks to a massive victory over the West. And so it's not a theological point, though they try to wrap theology in it. What it is they look at it as a point of almost Arab nationalism. In the extremist mindset, it was the culmination of the battle between East and West. The Crusader showed up and expelled them from the Holy Land, but then the great Muslim armies expelled the Western Crusaders, and then everything was peace, love, and harmony, I suppose. I don't know. In their mind's eye, not in reality, but in their mind's eye.
Do these three terror attacks represent a significant strategic change by ISIS?
It does represent a certain strategic change, because these sort of acts of terror, we're used to them perpetrating against Iraqis and Syrians. But now they're hitting airplanes, they're killing women and children. The absolute barbarism and brutality with which they perpetrated the massacres, particularly in the theater, you really start to see that this was an effort to bring the same war they've been fighting in Iraq and in Syria to the streets of Paris. It's a change in so much as they're now really trying to reach out and touch the West, reach out and touch the Western nations to strike out in the most brutal way possible, but using the same tactics of terror. Just now, instead of being on the streets of Baghdad, they're now in the streets of Paris.
What is the likelihood that they'll follow up with an attack on the United States?
I hate to sound like a pessimist, but I think it's very likely. A lot of it, I think, has to do with the fact that if you look at each attack, it has been to one-up the previous one. And it's been slowly escalating in a way that it pushes it closer and closer to the United States. First, they knock out the aircraft, which kills 200-some-odd people. Very devastating. But then they have the attack in Paris, which kills fewer people, but is more gruesome and takes place on the streets of a Western city. The crescendo to this fireworks of terror is going to be the United States. And when you look at it from a security standpoint, we're very vulnerable. There's a lot of talk of, well, you know, terrorists coming in disguised as Syrian refugees. Yes, that does pose a problem. But what amazes me is how nobody has mentioned this massive porous border we have with Mexico. Millions of illegal immigrants come into the United States through this border, brought in by traffickers known as coyotes, who are often affiliated with the drug cartels. Now, if these coyotes and these cartels can sneak millions of illegal immigrants across a porous border, is it really beyond the realm of imagination that for a couple $1 million, they would sneak, let's say, 2 ISIS operatives and a small dirty bomb into the United States? Probably not. Would it be that hard for them to do it? Probably not. They sneak billions of dollars worth of drugs into the United States, millions of people into the United States. We're worried about the refugees. We're completely neglecting this massive open border. So really, from a strategic standpoint, we are incredibly vulnerable.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. We're on the fourth Monday of the month from noon to 1 p.m. I'm Ken McDermott-Rowe, your host, and I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott-Rowe, our military affairs commentator. And we've been talking about the recent terrorist attacks by ISIS in Egypt and in Paris and in Beirut, Lebanon. Now, what to do about these attacks? What should the U.S. response be? Was a question that was raised in the most recent presidential debate, the Democratic debate on November the 14th. And Senator Bernie Sanders said, quote, "The United States cannot do it alone. The Muslim nations in the region, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Turkey, Jordan, all these nations, they're going to have to get their hands dirty, their boots on the ground." Well, Marshawn, well, Iran is already fighting ISIS in Syria and Iraq, as we've discussed. Some of the other nations of the regions are hanging back. So let's take a look at them one by one, starting with Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states. What's their position regarding ISIS?
Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states, it's very complicated because you do look at the nations that are fighting against ISIS, and they tend to be the ones that are much more secularist and pro-Russian, although obviously Iran's not secularist. Iran is an Islamic republic. The countries like the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Kuwait, the UAE, these countries are playing both sides. On the one hand, they were responsible for the financial rise of ISIS and indeed supplied a lot of the material to the ISIS and, of course, Al-Qaeda affiliates in Syria. Now, part of this is because the Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states are governed by an ideology known as Wahhabism. And Wahhabism is a militant form of Sunni Islam. It's a very puritanical form of Sunni Islam. Now, this is important because it was with the help of the Wahhabis that the Saudi royal family achieved power in Saudi Arabia. And it is with the help of Wahhabis that they maintained power. And so in return for this support, they agreed with the Wahhabis to propagate their ideology. So naturally, they have a automatic affinity for ISIS and for Al-Qaeda, the Saudi government does. And so that's point number one. And then number two also, for a lot of these states, they're looking at if they play both sides, if on the one hand they bankroll ISIS, on the other hand, they, you know, kind of look the other way, ISIS will leave them alone. It's almost the idea of, I'm going to kind of give you some money and I'm going to look the other way. Will you do whatever you do? Because look, you can kill the Shia in Saudi Arabia all you want, just leave me in power. And I think that's the attitude of the Saudi and the Gulf governments. Bombs were going off set by ISIS operatives in Saudi Arabia and in Kuwait, but since they hit Shiite mosques, there was no outrage from the Saudi or Kuwaiti governments. Instead, they went and invaded Yemen, which is kind of counterintuitive. But that's really where the policy of Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states stem from, is one a common ideology and two, a desire to remain in power at all costs.
And yes, they have been pounding Yemen for some time now from the air. The Saudi fear is the Yemeni government is basically a front for Iran. I don't know if that's true or not, but they do not want an Iranian ally on their southern border.
Which tells you a lot about the Saudi mentality. Why is it that they are more afraid of a Shiite pro-Iran Yemen than they are of a militant ISIS that wants to wipe out anybody who doesn't think like them? The only reason logically they wouldn't be, they'd be more afraid of Iran than they are of ISIS is because they have something in common with ISIS and they've done a dirty deal with ISIS. And I think that's really, when you look at what Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states are doing, I think that explains a lot of it.
Could the Saudis' refusal to cooperate end up splitting with the U.S.? But on the other hand, they were acting on our behalf originally when they facilitated bringing jihadists to Syria.
Reasonably speaking, there would be a split. But at the end of the day, let's face it, we need Saudi oil right now. And the Gulf states provide us with a naval base on the Persian Gulf. And they provide us with military bases in Kuwait and Qatar. Whether we like it or not, right now, at least the way the administration sees it, is we need the Saudis.
So we're not likely to see a ramped up Saudi or Gulf state military involvement in Syria?
No, no, it's highly unlikely. I mean, it really would be, it really would be tantamount to the Soviet Union launching a military campaign against North Vietnam. It's just they share a common ideology, and ISIS is serving Saudi's ends, which is to wipe out the Shia and therefore wipe out both Persian and dissent, the interests of dissenters in the Middle East. So ISIS is serving a wider goal in terms of helping Saudi Arabia.
Let's turn to Turkey, which is a NATO ally of the United States, has a very powerful military. It wants to join the European Union. They have a lot of potential to play a military role in Syria and Iraq against ISIS, but the Kurdish situation complicates it.
Very much so, because a lot of people say, well, why is it Turkey won't get involved? Why is it Turkey won't send in its massive army? And a lot of this has to do with the fact that Turkey has been fighting a guerrilla war against the Kurds inside its own borders for decades, and it's been very bloody, and the war just started up again. If the Turkish army were to go into Syria or into Iraq, both of which, the northern regions of which are predominantly Kurdish, the Turks would find themselves embroiled in not only fighting a ground war against ISIS, but now fighting a guerrilla war against the Kurds. The Turks know they have to do something about ISIS, but at the same hand, they don't want to end up involving themselves in two wars. A ground war against ISIS for them would also result in a ground war against the Kurds. And I think that's something that they're just really not, they're trying to avoid at all costs at this stage.
So right now they're letting us have our fighters take off from Turkish soil, but we're not going to see them involved a whole lot more.
I don't think so, at least for the time being, because they know a ground campaign will result in, instead of fighting one enemy, which is what they're doing right now, they'll be fighting two.
Let's look at Jordan, which is on the southern edge of Syria. It's still run by a dynasty which was put into power by the British at the end of World War I as a result of the Sykes-Picot Treaty, which we mentioned earlier. What's Jordan's role now? Could it be greater?
Jordan's in a tough position because King Abdullah of Jordan is vehemently anti-ISIS. He's very pro-Western. He was Jordanian Special Forces, and he's very, very well educated. He attended the British Military Academy at Sandhurst, and he's one of our staunchest allies, and a close ally of Israel, too. The problem Jordan faces is, on the one hand, it has a very small army, and on the other hand, it has a lot of territory to protect. So Jordan's primary concern right now is that ISIS has been trying to expand across the Jordanian border, because Jordan is, by and large, a lot of desert. It has some very populous areas, but a lot of desert, and desert is hard to protect. If all of Canada had gone ISIS, and we were trying to secure that massive border we have with Canada, and we had an army the size of, let's say, that of Ireland, we'd really be in a tough spot. And that's where Jordan finds itself. Massive border to secure and a very small army. So while Jordan has been contributing with the air campaign, it's really in a tough bind to try to contribute more, at least without assurances from its other Arab neighbors of support.
Yes, and they've also, I understand, been allowing us to use their soil as a staging area.
Absolutely. They've been very supportive in terms of allowing us to stage there and in terms of allowing our special forces to operate out of Jordanian military bases. Again, Jordan's one of our staunchest allies, but Jordan's only handicap is that its military is tiny and its population is small.
Let's turn now to Lebanon. We've already mentioned that Hezbollah is fighting in Syria alongside Syrian government forces, in some cases under Iranian leadership. What is your evaluation of Hezbollah's current contribution to the war? Could it do any more?
Well, I think Hezbollah has made an incredible contribution to the fight against ISIS in terms of they offer a lot of combat experience. Hezbollah has been involved in combat since the Lebanese civil war against the other militias, against the Israelis. They fought the Israelis in the 2006 war. So they have a lot of expertise, particularly in urban warfare. So they have brought not so much numbers, but they have brought a level of combat experience and expertise, which has been a real contributing factor to ISIS being stopped and then pushed back in Syria.
And I understand they also domestically in Lebanon have pretty good relationships with the Christians today so that they can cooperate with most Sunnis, even though they are Shia, as well as with Western Christians.
Well, one of the things that's interesting when you study Hezbollah is that they are in many ways much more of a Lebanese nationalist movement. They're wrapped in the banner of the Iranian revolution, of Shiaism and things like that. But in reality, they are first and foremost a Lebanese nationalist movement. And I think it's interesting. I saw a documentary a long time ago where they were interviewing people who work for Al-Manar, which is the Hezbollah TV station. And there were Christians and Sunnis and Shia working there. And it struck me because it really, I think, and it explains why they're able to get along with all the other political parties in Lebanon, because they are first and foremost Lebanese nationalists. The whole Shia, pan-Shiaism, the whole Iranian revolutionary thing is really much more symbolic than it is a statement of actual political ideology. Really, they are Lebanese nationalists, which is, I think, is also why they are also able to secure so much of Lebanon and prevent ISIS from being able to infiltrate, even though ISIS has tried to infiltrate into Lebanon. Both the Lebanese army and Hezbollah have been able to stop them because they do work in conjunction with each other.
Let's turn also to Israel. Israel has been, of course, at war with Lebanon on many occasions. Does not this complicate Israel's potential involvement in the Syrian war?
Well, Israel in a lot of ways is between a rock and a hard place because on the one hand, Israel finds itself in a position where if ISIS wins, ISIS's next final step, their final step after defeating the Syrians and the Russians and the Americans and so on and so forth, after dominating the Middle East, will be to wipe Israel off the face of the earth. And so that obviously poses a big threat to Israel. On the other hand, a victory of pro-Russian forces, to include the Iranians, does hem Israel into a corner. Although Israel's never been afraid of being backed into a corner. They're used to being backed into a corner. But it does put Israel in a very awkward situation in terms of it's really a lose-lose. And Israel runs a risk of getting directly militarily involved because it could help throw fuel onto the fire of ISIS. Now it would turn ISIS's attention directly onto Israel. I think Israel right now is in a very complex situation. The only reason why ISIS hasn't gone after Israel right at the moment is because Israel is, militarily speaking, not only very strong, but it wields a huge psychological influence in the Arab world in that no Arab army has ever defeated Israel. And so ISIS will not strike at Israel until it is in a position of absolute power. And that, in a sense, provides a little bit of security. But again, it is a lose-lose situation for Israel.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott-Rowe, your host, and I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott-Rowe, our military affairs commentator. With reference to the war in ISIS, Senator Bernie Sanders and other candidates for president brought up how should we respond to the recent terror attacks? Should the United States take a lead? And there seems to be a growing sentiment that we should be looking more to other countries, in particular our Arab allies, to carry more of the weight in the fight against ISIS. So we've been talking about the various countries in the region and what contribution they've made or could make to the war against ISIS. Now I'd like to turn to Egypt, which is actually the most populous Arab country. Egypt's ability to support the U.S. war against ISIS in Syria, Iraq is hampered by the fact that it's already fighting ISIS at home. Could you talk about the ISIS movement within Egypt?
Egypt is now battling ISIS in the Sinai, which is more or less called the Sinai province of the Islamic State, quote unquote. The group that calls itself that used to be called Ansar Beit al-Maqdis. This group was a largely born out of the Bedouins. It's a militant Wahhabi movement. And they were fighting against Western influence and autonomy from the Egyptian government. But they capitalized on the emergence of ISIS and declared themselves a province of ISIS. Well, what this did was this brought in a tremendous amount of support from ISIS, mainly in the form of training and expertise, foreign fighters, ISIS military commanders, and resources. And from there, they've been using it to bloody the Egyptian army very badly. The fact is that the Egyptians have lost hundreds. We're not talking a couple, like 10, 12. They've lost hundreds of soldiers battling ISIS in the Sinai. One of the things that helps Egypt, though, is the fact that it's a movement really isolated to the Sinai, because the average Egyptian, I spent a lot of time in Egypt, and the average Egyptian is well-educated enough to know they don't want to live in an ISIS-styled state. The average Egyptian can read and write, which, as mundane as that sounds, as much as we take that for granted in developed countries, being able to read or write allows you to actually be able to say, well, you know what, these extremists don't know what they're talking about. It allows you to actually be able to think much more so for yourself, just having that basic skill. And that's why you see the countries that are really able to resist ISIS are the countries and the regions that have the highest level of education. Places like Sinai, amongst the Bedouins, education does not come very common.
Is ISIS playing a game within the tribal politics of the Sinai? As I understand it, some of the more established tribes are being threatened now by upstart tribes that have allied themselves with ISIS.
Absolutely. And that's a very old story in the Arab world, that the upstart tribes will ally themselves with the new up-and-coming power, and while the older tribes will find themselves marginalized. That is one of the ways in which the Saudi royal family was able to come to power, by allying itself with the Wahhabis. They were able to push out the other tribes that opposed them, some of which were older. So you do see this pattern, particularly in Bedouin Arab history.
Now, Egypt, unlike some of the other Arab countries, is not an oil producer. However, its importance relies in geography. And I think we should remind listeners that Egypt is critical because it provides the pathway from the Mediterranean Ocean to the Indian Ocean via the Suez Canal.
Absolutely. And control of the Suez Canal is vital. If, realistically speaking, ISIS is not going to get control of the Suez Canal, but imagine if they did, though, that would impact all shipping. Now, the majority of our oil that comes from the Persian Gulf doesn't sail around India. It sails up the Gulf of Aden and through the Sinai and the Suez Canal. Being able to control the Suez Canal would allow whoever occupied it to shut off the West's access to oil.
Sure. If you didn't have the Suez Canal, you'd have to sail all the way around the southern tip of Africa.
Exactly. And so that really is why the Sinai is so important, and why the Egyptians have been fighting so hard to defend it.
Well, we just finished a review of the countries in the region. One other question I wanted to ask you, Marshawn, is what is the prospect that ISIS could extend its reach into the Western Hemisphere in a country like, say, Mexico?
I think it's very likely. In fact, it's believed they already have. There have been reports that I've read that ISIS has terror cells operating out of Juarez, and that they have been cutting deals with the drug cartels. The cartels are more well-armed than the Mexican army is. If ISIS were to be cooperating with the cartels, they would have an entire military arsenal at their disposal. So I think it is very likely that they are operating in Mexico. And also, let's face it, Mexico is borderline a failed state. And so law and order doesn't control Mexico's borders, and it doesn't control access into Mexico. Money and the crime bosses are the ones who make the rules. And they would, I believe, have very few scruples about aiding ISIS in coming through and causing trouble for the United States, so long as ISIS threw a couple million their way.
You know, as we've reviewed the countries that are participating in the war against ISIS in Syria and Iraq, one of the things struck me is that there's a very little part being taken by the U.S. allies in the region, but a substantial part being taken by Russia's allies in the region. Could you talk about that?
Really, to me, this speaks to Bernie Sanders' total lack of military experience and total lack of any aggregate knowledge of military affairs. Because to say, oh, the Arabs have to be at boots on the ground, well, the Arabs are. It's Arab soldiers that are dying. The problem is that they're Iraqi Shia, they're Hezbollah, Lebanese Shia, they're Egyptians, they're Syrian soldiers, they're Iranians. The problem is that these are all Russian allies. The Egyptians are Sunnis, but they're Russian allies still. The Lebanese are Shia, they're Russian allies. The Iranians are Shia, they're Russian allies. And the fact is that our allies aren't doing any of the fighting. Our allies are the ones who are supporting ISIS. So really, when Bernie Sanders says the Arabs need to do more of the fighting, he's not talking about the Arabs who are actually fighting. He's talking about the right Arabs. He's talking about the pro-American Arabs. Because the problem is the pro-American Arabs have been the ones that have been supporting ISIS. It's the pro-Russian Arabs that have been doing all the fighting. And that to me just speaks of how Bernie, not just Bernie Sanders, but a lot of the candidates really don't understand the military situation as it stands in Iraq, in Syria, in Sinai, because the Arabs are fighting. The problem is, and they are meeting with military success now that they're being supported by the Russian allies. The problem is they're not the ones that we want to have win.
I don't mean to single out Senator Sanders, because as I listen to the debates, there does seem to me to be a very great lack of knowledge of foreign policy on the part of all the candidates. Occasionally someone says something that seems to make some sense. Republican candidate Donald Trump said that he welcomed the participation of Russia in Syria. He said, why not let them carry the load, and said that we could devote more of our resources to rebuilding our economy. It seemed to make some sense to me. But in general, they seem to be not very well informed.
Well, and that's the thing. Donald Trump is taking a very pragmatic approach. He's saying that who cares who defeats ISIS as long as ISIS is defeated? And that's my whole point. When they say, oh, the Arabs aren't doing the fighting, well, okay, so the pro-American Arabs aren't doing the fighting. The pro-American Arabs are all supporting ISIS under the table because they're Wahhabi militants, but the pro-Russian Arabs are fighting ISIS. Well, who cares who defeats ISIS as long as ISIS gets defeated? At the end of the day, if ISIS is defeated, we can do business with the pro-Russian Shia government of Iraq. We can do business with the pro-Russian Sunni government of Egypt. But we can't cut a deal. I mean, who'd want to cut a deal with ISIS anyway? So what does it matter who wins as long as ISIS is defeated? It's the same principle we had in World War II. Who cared exactly who came out on top as long as the Nazis were defeated?
Well, Marshawn, we're coming to the end of the show, and I'd just like you to take a moment at the end to give us your recommendations on what the United States should do, either individually as part of a coalition to defeat ISIS.
I think in the first place, what we need to do is our leadership needs to have a serious sit down with the Russians. And I think we need to take a Truman approach. Harry Truman was he established the spheres of influence. He was a brilliant political mastermind in this sense, in that he realized that the best way to deal with the post-World War II world was to establish spheres of influence with the Soviets. And that is what Churchill did with Stalin when they were at Yalta. They sat down and they said, and at Tehran, they sat down and they said, okay, you're going to get this, we're going to get this. And that's what we need to do in the Middle East, is sit down with the Russians and say, okay, you can have influence in Syria, Lebanon, Iran, and Egypt. That's fine. We will have influence in Saudi Arabia, the Gulf states, Jordan, Israel, and Turkey, for the sake of argument. And then this way we establish spheres of influence. This works also because it gives us zones of occupation, if you will, like we had in World War II, but zones of defeating ISIS. American forces will smash ISIS in Iraq. Russians will smash them in Syria. ISIS does not have the military capabilities to fight a two-front war against the world's two largest superpowers. At the same time, it would also allow us to establish an order. It would allow us to establish a new Middle Eastern order, much as like that was established at the end of World War II.
Well, thank you very much, Marshawn. That's it for this edition of the In Context War Report. The In Context War Report is produced by MDR Productions, Inc. and is broadcast at noon on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. This program will be archived at WPKN.org, at RadioForAll.org, and on our show's website, incontextreport.com. And you can sign up for podcasts of the series via iTunes and Radio for All. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and write to us at ken@mdrtalk.org. On behalf of In Context military affairs commentator Marshawn McDermott Rowe, this is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. Thanks for listening. See you next time.